Roberta, good morning. Thank you very much, Lee, and thank you to Yakutu Law and the IWA for the kind invitation to speak this morning. The Institute has done so much since it was founded 27 years ago to promote debate about Wales' future, and I've got a huge amount of respect for the work it does, and I for one hope that the very best work still lies ahead, because I think Wales needs it more than ever. An Institute thinking about Wales' needs for the future across a range of disciplines, economics and political science and sociology, really helping us to think for the future as a nation. Before really getting into the meat of my speech, I'd like to set out a bit of personal context, if I may. As many of you know, I hail from Pembrokeshire, right out geographically on the periphery of Wales, closer to Ireland than we are to Cardiff, culturally and linguistically divided for centuries, and known as Little England beyond Wales. My formative years were spent in Haverford West, in the heart of Pembrokeshire, but also in the shipyard town of Greenock in the west coast of Scotland. So I grew up fiercely proud of my shared Welsh and Scottish roots, fiercely proud of the Union, and understanding from a young age that to be British is to be a bit of a mixture, really. And knowing that the United Kingdom is a family of distinctive nations, bound together by virtue of sharing the same islands, and because the benefits of unity far outweigh the costs of division. And growing up believing that the Union has been, in so many ways, a stunning success story in terms of European and world history. I was, and I remain to my core, a Unionist. Like the city of Cardiff, Pembrokeshire voted against the creation of the National Assembly in 1997 in a very finely balanced referendum, and so it was left to our neighbours in Carmarthenshire to tip the scales. So when it comes to devolution, I guess you could say we were late starters. And for my own political party too, for reasons of our own history and outlook, devolution seemed an alien concept back in 1997. So we came out fighting for the status quo. But Conservatives are nothing if not pragmatic, and since then we've begun to help build and shape the new politics of Wales, rediscovering in the process values and ideas in our own traditions which are entirely consistent with decentralised decision-making and the building of strong institutions closer to the public. We have all come to understand that far from being an enemy of the Union, devolution, if done well, can breathe new life into the Union. And this is the point we're at today, when the Union needs to be reshaped if it is to survive through this century. During this summer, I visited Scotland three times to campaign alongside Conservative, Labour and Liberal Democrat activists to defend the Union. But I was reminded again on those visits just how far away Westminster is from the lives of most Scots. I stood inside the empty Parliament at Holyrood one afternoon with Ruth Davidson, and it struck me that this is no mere shadow of the Westminster Parliament. This is a full legislature in its own right. It's where Scots increasingly look for answers on so many of the issues they care about, and this Parliament is here to stay. And this growth in legitimacy and competence and authority is now unquestionably the path of our own Assembly, because the people of Wales have destined it to be so. I came away from Scotland on that Wednesday night before the referendum absolutely certain that whatever the outcome the following night, nothing would ever be the same again in terms of our constitution. And so Scotland's decision to remain part of the UK presents a unique opportunity to reshape the future of our Union, to make our United Kingdom work for all our nations, and to fulfil the aspirations of the people of these islands who want a stronger voice over their own affairs and their own institutions. And on the steps of Downing Street on that Friday morning, the Prime Minister made clear that he wants to see Wales at the heart of this new phase of thinking about the constitution of the UK. So today I want to explain how we fulfil that pledge and the Wales I would like to see as a result. This government already has a strong track record on devolution to Wales. In 2011, we delivered the referendum on full lawmaking powers for the Assembly, which resulted in the Assembly being able to legislate across the full range of its devolved policy areas. The same year, we established the Commission on Devolution in Wales, the Silk Commission, to look at the case for devolving tax and borrowing powers to Wales and whether any changes were needed to the Assembly's powers. That commission published two unanimous reports recommending significant further devolution to Wales, reports that were informed by wide-ranging public consultation across Wales and also the input of political representatives. We introduced the Wales Bill that will implement almost all of the Silk Commission's Part 1 recommendations, devolving a range of tax and borrowing powers to Wales, including landfill tax, stamp duty land tax, and subject to a referendum, some income tax. Since becoming Secretary of State in July, I've amended the bill further to remove the so-called lockstep restriction on those income tax powers and to devolve to the Assembly the decision on whether to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote in the tax referendum. Under this bill, for the first time, Welsh Government will become accountable for raising a proportion of the money it spends. The bill is now nearing the end of its parliamentary passage and I will expect it to receive royal assent early in the new year. I want the Welsh Government to call a referendum as quickly as possible once the bill is enacted to deliver those income tax powers. This will provide Welsh Government with a powerful tool to help the Welsh economy become more dynamic and it will make the Welsh Government more accountable to the people of Wales. But the Scottish referendum campaign has further energised the debate about how the union should develop and, crucially, about the further powers that should be devolved to the individual nations of our United Kingdom. We understand that. And so following the referendum, the government established a new cabinet committee chaired by William Hague, who's the leader of the House of Commons and, of course, a distinguished former Secretary of State for Wales, who will oversee this work on the Constitution. That committee on which I sit is looking at the devolved powers for England, Wales and Northern Ireland alongside new powers for Scotland. So now we have a unique opportunity to reshape the future of our union, possibly for decades to come. The appetite for change is there. People want a stronger voice over their own affairs. That's unmistakable in Scotland, it's discernible in England and palpable here in Wales. And it's a sentiment that cannot and will not be ignored. And I'm determined that Wales should not play second fiddle in the current debate on devolution. I want us to use this opportunity, this unique moment in our nation's history, to look positively at how we secure the best possible devolution settlement for Wales. And I want to move forward in a realistic, open-minded and pragmatic way. And at the end of it, I want a devolution settlement for Wales which is stronger and more balanced, which works for the people of Wales, and that includes a Welsh Government which is more accountable to the people who elect it. In short, I want a clear, robust and lasting devolution settlement for Wales. A settlement that ends the constant tiring debate about powers which has characterised Welsh politics for 15 years but which has so little resonance with Welsh voters, and lets the Assembly and Welsh Government get on with the job of delivering economic growth and improving public services. Wales has huge economic potential, as this week's UK Investment Summit in Newport will show. So let's end the arguments about devolution and focus on getting the Welsh economy in gear. I also want a settlement that fosters cooperation, not conflict, between either end of the M4. And I want a settlement that works for the people of Wales, where they understand which decisions are being taken at the UK level and which are taken here in Cardiff and why. So how will we get there? My goal is to seek a cross-party consensus on a stable long-term settlement for Wales. Sadly, the story of Welsh devolution has long been one of fixes, fudges and political expediency, of falling short and thinking short-term. We need to end the process of constantly tinkering with the devolution settlement. So let's get the devolution right for the longer term. Through this cross-party consensus, I intend to announce by St. David's Day next year a set of commitments agreed by the four main political parties in Wales on the way forward for Welsh devolution. Those commitments would form a basis, a baseline, for taking forward Welsh devolution after the general election next May. This means people in Wales will know, irrespective of which party or parties win the general election, that an agreed set of commitments will be taken forward in the next Parliament. I'm hopeful that we will be able to reach broad agreement on a way forward for Wales and set a course which puts Welsh devolution on the right track for the future. This process is, of course, not without risk. I've been told by some people that my hopes for a consensual approach is ambitious, but I'm optimistic. I sense that all parties are ready to seize the moment to put their differences aside. And there will, of course, be subjects on which the four political parties will not be able to agree. That's perfectly legitimate in our democracy. and that means at the ballot box next May, voters will have choice between the political parties on the extent and nature of further devolution to Wales. But it will be a choice underpinned by a solid baseline for change to which all four parties commit. Talks between the political parties will underpin this process. I've already begun that dialogue and had a very productive and constructive discussion last month with the Welsh leaders of the political parties in Westminster. We'll be meeting again next week to continue the discussion. And of course I should be meeting the leaders of the four parties here in the Assembly to hear their views. I know that those leaders have themselves been discussing future devolution, and last month the Assembly approved a cross-party motion setting out its priorities for the future devolution of Wales. I look forward to discussing those priorities with the party leaders soon. I'll also be seeking the views of Welsh business and of civic society in Wales on how they see devolution going forward. Doesn't mean repeating the extensive consultation work that Silk undertook, but I'll build on that. Devolution is too important just to leave to the politicians. So there are a number of distinct elements to this work. First, there is the overarching question of which model of devolution is right for Wales. We all know the problems with the current so-called conferred model of devolution. It's complicated, it means the devolution boundary is often blurred and indistinct, and crucially, it has meant laws that should be decided in Wales being decided instead in the Supreme Court. And that cannot be right. I want Welsh devolution to be clear. I want people to be able to understand who is responsible for what, and I want Welsh laws to be decided by the people of Wales and their elected representatives, not by lawyers in London. That's why I've asked my office to work on a reserve powers framework for Wales, the model which is already in place in Scotland. It means a different approach for Wales. Instead of defining what's devolved, as the current settlement does, it would define the powers reserved to the UK Parliament. The default will be that anything not reserved is devolved. And this is no mere technical change, it's a signal of the trust and the respect we have for the National Assembly of Wales. This was a key recommendation in the Silk Commission's second report, and there is already clear cross-party support for the change, both at Westminster and at the Assembly. A reserve powers model doesn't solve all the difficult questions about competency, but it will provide a clearer boundary for Welsh devolution and the right framework within which further devolution can take place. A reserve powers model will better be able to stand the test of time and deliver the stable and lasting settlement that Wales so urgently needs. And only a reserve powers model will end the absurdity of devolution questions being settled by lawyers in London rather than by the people of Wales and their elected representatives. By the 1st of March, I will publish what a reserve powers framework for Wales might look like. That will provide a firm basis to legislate early in the next Parliament to introduce the model for Wales. A remodelling of the current settlement to provide a sharper, clearer, and more stable basis for Welsh devolution is a start, but we need to go further. We need to ask ourselves, does the Assembly and the Welsh Government have the right set of powers to help deliver the jobs and the economic growth that Wales needs? Or could they do with more? Or could they do more with more? I understand the appetite of people in Wales for a stronger voice over their own affairs. I recognise that each time the people of Wales have been asked, they have voted for more devolution. And if further powers are devolved, we should be clear about the purpose for doing so. What would be the benefit to Wales? How would further powers help to deliver jobs and economic growth? We have unfinished business in the shape of the Silk Commission's second report. The Commission made 61 recommendations in that report setting out the further powers it thought should be devolved to Wales and how the way in which London and Cardiff do business can be improved. So secondly, I want to work cross-party and with the Welsh Government to identify which of those Silk recommendations for further devolution we can reach consensus on. One of those recommendations was, of course, moving to a reserve powers model, and so our search for consensus has got off to a positive start. I'm confident that cross-party agreement can be reached on many more. I'll also be talking to other key players. Next week, for example, I'm meeting the Assembly's presiding officer, Dame Rosemary Butler, who has clear views on issues such as the Assembly's working practice and devolving arrangements for Assembly elections, and I'm particularly keen to hear these arguments. There is, of course, work going on in Scotland to strengthen the powers of the Scottish Parliament within the UK. A commission headed by Lord Smith of Kelvin is leading a cross-party process to agree the detail of what those powers should be. At the end of this month, the Smith Commission will publish a unifying set of proposals, a heads of agreement, with recommendations for further devolution to the Scottish Parliament. This process will result in the UK Government publishing draft clauses by the 25th of January, setting out the further powers to be devolved. It will be important that we identify the proposals arising from the Smith Commission that warrant further consideration and analysis for Wales. And so this is the third element of the work we're beginning. I'm certainly not saying that what is right for Scotland will necessarily be right for Wales, but I believe it's important for each of the devolved settlements to have the right set of powers for that particular nation. But we shouldn't let the opportunity provided by the Smith Commission slip by without thinking which of its proposals need to be given further thought in a Welsh context. And then fourthly, I recognise that there are questions around fair funding for Wales. I know that people are concerned about the levels of funding for Welsh public services. It's a concern I often hear when I speak to business and people all across Wales. We've all heard the figure of £300 million a year in underfunding that Professor Jerry Holtham identified back in 2010. It's true that in the 10 years up to 2010, levels of funding for devolved services in Wales got ever closer to the levels for equivalent services in England. But since then, the opposite has happened, so that funding for Welsh public services is now around 15% higher than equivalent funding in England. And this is actually around the level that Professor Holtham himself said was acceptable when he did his review. Back in 2012, we agreed a process with the Welsh Government to keep funding levels under review and to work to find a solution if it's likely that Welsh funding again heads towards the levels that's being spent in England. Building on this, the UK and Welsh Governments have agreed to revisit the arrangements for considering relative funding in light of the powers in the Wales Bill. But let's be clear, the issue of funding must not be used either as a roadblock to further devolution or as an excuse for poor performance. The margin of difference we're talking about here in terms of overall budget levels is tiny, between 1% and 2% at most. So I want to see a Welsh Government that stands up proudly and says the buck stops here. Make no mistake, all this is an ambitious programme of work, but I am ambitious for Wales. I want Welsh devolution to be clearer, stronger and more balanced. And I want Wales to stand proud in a reshaped union. With the Welsh Government accountable to the people of Wales, clear about its role and responsibilities and focused on the issues that really matter, economic growth, jobs and better public services. It is right for the political parties to put aside their differences to deal with the key issue of what the right devolution settlement for Wales should look like. Only by working together across the political spectrum, across parties and between the two governments, can we show the people of Wales ahead of the next election that we're serious about strengthening devolution and making it work for all the people of Wales. By St David's Day next year, we will publish a blueprint signed up to by all four main parties in Wales for taking forward Welsh devolution in the next Parliament. Parties may go further in their election committees commitments, but my promise to the people of Wales is this. Whoever you elect next year, you will know that a baseline set of powers will be coming to Wales and you will know what a reserve powers model will look like. The next Parliament will be faced with the huge task of reshaping the constitutional settlements of all parts of the United Kingdom. And for Wales, I want to be able to hit the ground running. Finally, I want to present a challenge to the Welsh Government. I want to see further devolution to Wales, but I also want to see devolution within Wales, from Cardiff to all four corners of our nation. I'm committed to localism, and I want to see decisions taken at the most local level possible. That should mean more decisions being taken by local authorities and local communities in Wales, and fewer decisions being made centrally by Welsh Government. The UK Government has reinvigorated local government in England through our localism agenda and is unfolding an exciting devolution vision for reviving the great northern cities, the northern powerhouse, as centres of real economic and civic strength. And my message to the Welsh Government is to do the same in Wales. The 21st century constitution will be about pushing power downwards. Decentralised decision making backed up with real economic and financial powers to harness innovation and growth. This can be an exciting template for Wales too. I want a new era for devolution in Wales, one which means that political debate in Wales evolves from demands for more powers and more money, to one where the central question becomes, how do we use the powers and resources we have to deliver the very best for Wales? That's my vision. Powers for a purpose, a settlement that delivers for people in Wales, and a devolved government accepting responsibility for failures as well as celebrating its successes.
Thank you, Will. Stephen's kindly agreed to answer questions, and I'd like to start off with a couple, if I might, and then we'll open it up. The IWA is launching an initiative to have a crowdsourced constitutional convention to try and get the debate beyond the political classes. Now, it seems to me that the debate in Scotland in the Smith Commission and your own committee with the party leaders is an elite-led conversation. What do you intend to do to make sure that the broadest possible number of people are involved in that discussion?
So it's a very good question. I would disagree with you that it's an elite-led conversation, because it's a conversation based on the strong voice of the people of Scotland with respect to the Smith Commission, but also the voice that we're listening to here in Wales. There is an appetite in Wales for more devolution, and it's right that you call it the elite, it's right that the politicians respond to that. So by taking forward this process now, we're showing that we are in touch with the feeling within Wales, but it's right that we don't just keep the conversation amongst ourselves, which is why I made the point that devolution is too important just to leave to the politicians. We need to reach out and listen to what business is saying to us, listen to what civic society and the wider population. And they need to see that there's something at stake. Because that was another lesson from Scotland, is you know, talk about the enormous engagement of the 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds in Scotland. It's because they sensed that something real was at stake for the future of their nation. And I think it's incumbent upon us politicians to show the wider population in Wales that actually these issues really matter, that there's something for them to think about their future. And that will hopefully engage them on a wider basis.
So how are you going to do that?
Good question. The Silk Commission as well did a lot of work on this, and we have a wide programme of meetings with business. I've already sat down with CBI to talk about what their business members are telling them about this next stage of devolution in light of the Scottish referendum. We're having discussions with the Federation of Small Business and the IOD as well. But beyond that, you know, we want to talk to the third sector, and my colleague Baroness Randerson is leading on that work. But a lot of this work has been done in terms of the Silk Commission's work, and so it's timely that we don't just keep reaching out for consultation. Actually, it's a time for action as well, and you need to actually be in a position to say, right, well, we've heard the voice, we know what direction people in Wales want us to take, and we're going to crack on with it.
Okay, well, we certainly welcome a chance to work with you for our constitutional convention to help with that. My second question is, you talked about pushing power downwards, and clearly England is going to get more devolution as a result of the Hague proposals, we assume. Manchester is getting extra powers and an elected mayor, but both those processes are happening without the referendum, and you again repeated that the important principle the Welsh Government stops getting a chance to make excuses, has to show the buck stops with them, but you're still insisting on a referendum taking place before that happened. If it's a matter of principle and a matter of playing the other parts of the UK, why are you still having to have referenda in Wales?
Well, the crucial difference is that with all of the localism examples we're using there, we're not talking about devolving income tax. People of Scotland had a specific question on their referendum question originally at the start of their devolution journey to ask about income tax powers, and it was felt by the Silk Commission, and the strong feeling still is, that that is right on a constitutional basis to put to the people of Wales that question of whether they want their Assembly to have income tax raising powers. It's an important step forward, and that's why we still think it's valid. But if there are parties out there who think that we've gone past that, it's free for them to put that in their manifesto and make the case to people of Wales.
Okay, so if it's in the manifestos, a referendum could be bypassed.
Well, we still think it's an important step to put before the people of Wales that question in a referendum. But if other parties think that it isn't, then they're free to put that in their referendum.
Okay, so please ask your question. If you could say who you are before you ask your question. So.
Peter Price, Chair of Cymru Fory. One of the issues that you didn't mention in setting out your agenda for subjects for the talks was the capacity of the Assembly. You mentioned, for example, talking to Rosemary Butler, but referred to it in terms of working methods only. When the Assembly was set up as a demonstration that it wasn't going to be anything like the Scottish Parliament, the Scottish Parliament was given 129 members in order to do the job that it had. In Wales, to demonstrate this was a much lesser sort of organisation, it was accorded only 60. The Richard Commission, on which I served, indicated at that time 80 was a minimum number. Since then, we're talking about tax powers and a much wider range of powers altogether. Surely this is time for that to be an important part of the agenda. Will it be?
Well, it will be if people want to put it on the agenda. And I thoroughly expect Rosemary Butler to put it on the agenda in her meeting with me next week. But for the Assembly to take some leadership on this as well, if the strong feeling is that there isn't the capacity there, we need to be hearing more people say that. Now, it's a difficult climate for any politician to go out there and make the case to the people that for expenditure on more politicians. But if there's a strong case for that, someone needs to be making it. I'm starting this whole process very genuinely, very open-minded about what the future looks like, and clearly these are important issues. But people shouldn't be shy about that if they really believe that there's a case for increasing the number of Assembly members in Cardiff.
Okay.
Dan Hill from Positive. You mentioned in your speech that the history of devolution, I think your phrase was, had been characterised by fudgings, fixes and political expediency. I'm sure I'm not alone in this room in looking back at the last two Government of Wales Acts and seeing a lot of resonance in that particular phrase. And I think also back 18 months when the Wales Government Centre hosted a talk by your predecessor, which I'm not going to ask you to reflect on, when Silk Part 2 still hadn't concluded his work, he ruled out a reserve powers model and ruled out pretty much all the major pieces of devolution that Silk Part 2 then went on to recommend. And Steve, I must say, I think in 4 months, you've done more than the previous 4 years in terms of changing the tone, which Lee referred to at the start, in terms of and looking for something stable and workable. And I think it was an important speech that you made here today. And it seems to me that the Conservative Party has finally come to terms with devolution at long last. And it's been a long and difficult journey where actions have not always matched words. And I no longer see your party as a reactionary movement in terms of devolution, which it seemed to have become again. And that seems to have changed. So if you're not the reaction and the barriers anymore, where do you think that now lies to this new vision you're presenting?
I was wondering where the punchline was coming. I detect a really strong appetite amongst all the parties for taking this forward, and I think there is this moment of people want to roll up their sleeves and work together, and I think you've kind of alluded to the path of progress that my own party has made, and you're right, it hasn't been an easy one. Back in 1997 we saw ourselves fundamentally unionist, and our understanding of unionism at that time of defending the union meant fighting against something that was starting to become clear to many people, if not ourselves, that this is going to be the future. The era of highly centralised Westminster government was coming to an end, and perhaps others spotted it before we did. But actually, you know, and I alluded to this in my own speech a few moments ago, there are, you know, powerful traditions within conservatism that support decentralisation and support the concept of devolution, and maybe we've been rediscovering some of those in recent years. In terms of where are the reactionary barriers now to progress, I think... You know, certainly talking to colleagues up in Westminster from my party and Labour, there's still areas where we need to think through what the future looks like, and that's not going to be a smooth and easy process. Liberal Democrats and Plaid Cymru are identified as those parties who all of us comes most easily to, but I know from talking to some of them that not all of these issues are clear cut. If it was easy, we'd be there by now, right? It's difficult, and so what I'm trying to set out is a process that we can all participate on an equal basis the spirit of cooperation and try and get to an end point which stands the test of time.
Thank you. If there's any further questions.
Nick, that's my fee. You talked about your ambition for robust and lasting settlements, but at the same time you talked about how you were going to look at the SILT recommendations with the other parties, see if there's which ones you could all agree on. And then when it came to Scotland, you said you'd look at those, necessarily, of course, don't even know what they are yet, implement those for Wales. Isn't it inevitable that for as long as there are certainly SILT recommendations that have not been enacted, and for as long as Scotland is in the UK with things that Wales has not got, the settlement will always be under continuous challenge?
I think that's a fair point. What we're trying to do with this, though, is take a bigger step forward than has been done in the past, to actually settle some of these issues that have been niggling away for a number of years now. And by taking a bigger step forward than perhaps people had anticipated we would, maybe we can provide some breathing space for a longer period when we're not constantly obsessed with talking about powers. And you know, one of the things underlining my vision of devolution is that in 15 years, the Welsh Commentary Act, if you want to call it that, has enjoyed talking about devolution and powers probably more than it's enjoyed talking about any other issues. When I knock on doors down there in West Wales or in any constituency, these aren't the issues that the people of Wales raise first and foremost in terms of their day-to-day concerns. What they think about and are concerned about are jobs, about the quality of their public services and the society in which they're raising their children. And for every hour that we spend discussing, debating, obsessing about powers is an hour that we're not spent focusing on our educational outcomes as a nation of Wales, our health outcomes and these things. And it wasn't anyone from my party, I think it was a Welsh Labour minister himself who said that we took our eye off the ball when it came to education. So, you know, if you think about what the long-term vision is, by settling some of these devolution issues, you create more space in the political process for actually focusing on the things that really, really matter to the people of Wales and which are really important for Wales in the 21st century.
Adrian Masters, ATP. If it's the Commentary Act, and I don't know what Wayne Phil Sharp meant, but they didn't talk about these things, and party leaders that are obsessed with the Constitution, but not people, why are you pushing ahead with this process? I understand what's happened in Scotland. There was a great move for it, but if that move hasn't been happening in Wales, why push ahead with it?
Well, let's distinguish between the constant day-to-day debate about devolution and the deep underlying aspiration and ambition on the part of the people of Wales for that greater voice over decisions taken that affect Wales. So let's not confuse the two things here. The reason that we are responding in this way and taking forward in this work is to respond to that deep aspiration and wish on the part of the people of Wales for that greater voice, that greater say over their own decisions, over their own institutions, issues that affect their nation. And that's very real. It's the point about the day-to-day thinking through the specifics of SILT commissions and things which perhaps people in Wales don't spend so much time talking about.
Okay, I have two questions, which we can take them together, Stephen Geeran and then Richard.
And Geeran Talman Davis. If I can sort of ask two questions really in a way. One is, when the famous vow was published in Scotland, just before the referendum, there was clearly a worry in some parts of the Labour Party in particular that so much was being promised that there was actually a danger in that to the Union itself. Do you share that concern at all? And that's one question. Secondly, as the Smith Commission tries to take that process further, where is Wales' input into that coming from? You know, are we talking about two separate bilateral discussions between Scotland and London on the one hand and Wales and London on the other? And my last point is this, in terms of your timetable, the 1st of March, that's only 3 months away. You've got Christmas and New Year between. You've got a Wales Bill to get through. Do you actually have the resource to actually complete that work on the reserve powers model in that time?
Okay, about two or three questions there. Take them in reverse order. Yeah, I mean, it's an ambitious timescale, and I have officials of mine from the Wales office in this room who are working very, very hard to deliver on that. And if we are going to deliver it, it's going to need goodwill and cooperation from the other parties and from our other stakeholders that we engage with. No question about that. That's the only way we're going to actually get to the point that we'd like to get to by the 1st of St. David's, if there is that spirit of cooperation and pragmatism to take us to that point. The question about are these two very separate bilateral discussions, they are and they're not, in that, you know, clearly the Scottish conversation is primarily amongst Scottish parties with reference back to London. They have the Wales work, and there's also the English work going on as well. All of this is brought together in a coherent mix, which is under William Hague's Cabinet Committee. That is the, if you like, the receptacle for all of this work and the body that makes sense of it and gives it some coherence. But I thoroughly expect that when we get into the next Parliament, we're actually legislating for these things. There will need to be more read across, and also there does need to be more thinking about the Union, about how the different relationships all hang together and what it is that fosters unity in a new age of devolution. These are really, really important questions. And your first question was around the vow and whether people felt there was a lot of risk attached to it. I mean, the risks in all of this, you know, the day that Britain set out on its devolution journey back in 1997-98, there were risks to that. And there are risks, of course, to not doing anything at all. The status quo itself is risking. The decision that was taken in relation to Scotland was that the risks of not taking that unified step as the main parties, you know, the consequences would be that Scotland would take a decision that didn't want to be part of the Union anymore.
Okay, Richard.
Richard and Jones, Wales Government Centre, part of the commentariat who's been going on about this for the last 15 yeah. years. I can assure you that we'd quite like to talk about other things, but part of the problem, as I think you admitted, is that we've had botched settlements in the past, and so that some of those who were warning about ELCOs and about conferred powers feel kind of vindicated.
Yeah.
One of the kind of big difficult issues which remains to be discussed is the whole legal jurisdiction, the whole justice agenda. And Karen Jones has long warned that, you know, to have two legislatures working within one jurisdiction is anomalous and ultimately unstable. The Silk 2 report talks about a longer-term, decade kind of agenda of devolving, looking at and devolving within the sphere of justice. Is there any appetite at all within your own party to go down that road? Because, you know, many of us feel that this is the next agenda, and yet at the moment it appears that your own party is balking even at devolving police, when there is clear majority support in Wales for doing precisely that. So I kind of would push you a little bit on that aspect, which I know is difficult and complicated, maybe not only for your party, but particularly maybe for the Conservative Party in Wales. Is there any appetite, given this expansive view, given this aim for a long-term settlement, which I wholly welcome, is there an appetite to look at that agenda going forward?
So on the policing point there, you're right, it isn't just my party. I think the Shadow Police Minister, the Labour MP David Hanson, I think himself, has spoken about the enormous difficulties involved in beginning to think about devolving policing in Wales. So yeah, there are issues across the parties on that question. You're right, the issue of a devolved jurisdiction, a Welsh legal system, I mean, that's much more long-term. And, speaking very honestly, it's not part of the current discussions. Doesn't mean it doesn't have to be. If people want to put it on the agenda and talk about that, then let's do that. But in terms of the time frame that we're operating to, it's not in the mix at the moment.
Okay, we have time for many more questions, but...
thank you. Ian McKinley, the implications of what we're discussing this morning, inevitably a few years away, the actual implications of what we're discussing a year or two away, and by then we could it's quite possible we could have had a referendum that brings United Kingdom out of the European Union. So I think the sort of things we're discussing have got to be discussed with that possibility in mind. And one of the things that does come to mind is a precedent in terms of the state of the Kingdom of Denmark, I think it's called, when Greenland, which was originally in the European Union, voted to leave it. Just supposing we had a referendum in UK terms to leave the European Union, Scotland and Wales are going to be very unhappy with that result. And is there a possibility of letting England go its own way? England leaves the European Union and leaves Ireland, Wales and Scotland in it.
So we're deep in hypotheticals. We'll try and unpick that and give a coherent answer. The decision-making unit for any referendum on membership of the EU will be UK-wide. So if you think back to the referendum in 97 in Wales, because the city of Cardiff and Pembrokeshire and others voted, the majorities didn't vote to support the creation of that. There was no discussion that they should somehow opt out. I mean, there were people at the time. they weren't taken very seriously, and rightly so. Wales was the decision-making unit, and it was made on the basis of a simple majority, and that will apply for a referendum with respect to the UK. I would caution about seeing public opinion in Wales on Europe as vastly different from mainstream public opinion elsewhere. The most recent polls I've seen suggest that there's a fairly even split in Wales between those who are saying at the moment come out or stay in, and then there's a body of people in the middle who are genuinely undecided. And I suspect most would veer towards staying in. I don't think there's a majority either in England or in Wales, for that matter, at the moment, who want to come out of the EU. So I wouldn't necessarily see Wales being so distinct from the rest of the country in terms of its opinions.
Okay, I have a quick one if you would.
Howard Kerry Jones, you referred, and I liked it, to the idea of building up a cross-party consensus on the next steps, St. David's Day agenda, and what would happen afterwards. And you gave a very cryptic, brief, naturally, reference to the UK level. Do you see, as part of this build-up in the short term, the idea of a constitutional settlement that would at least set out some of the common basic principles that should govern the future construction of the Union? And linked to that, there's been quite a lot of speculation about the idea of a constitutional convention, including from Kerry. How do you see all that, and how does this fit in to the framework of your thinking?
So we've been saying that one of the forgotten elements of the devolution agenda has been the English question, or the West Lothian question. And there's work currently going on now, led by William Hague, to address that through English votes on English laws. But I suspect that the real forgotten bit of the devolution agenda is who's thinking about the union. And when we progress with this next generation of devolution, where is the thinking about what binds us together and holds us together, and what fosters cooperation rather than foster disunity and competitiveness between the what will be competing poles of political authority, right? And so in the new parliament, as we're taking forward this legislation on Scotland and Wales, I would hope that there's a body of work that is also thinking government-wide and beyond that about the future of the Union and how it hangs together, and whether that's in the form of a constitutional convention, we will see. But clearly there is that appetite that's growing for that.
Can I finish with a question about party question, if you like? Because I think your speech this morning is a very significant shift, certainly in tone and language, about the party positioning. And I dare say it's part of a broader strategic move trying to reposition the Conservative Party as a more pro-devolution party. I've noticed your point about a powerful political tradition and conservatism that promotes decentralisation and devolution. And I just want to explore just a tiny bit of the risk of that, because there is about 20% of the voters who are still not reconciled to devolution amongst your own party voters and your own activists especially. There's a great unease about this. And isn't there a danger in seating that consensus and putting yourself on that side of the debate, that you're leaving open a part of the electorate for UKIP to step into that space. You know, who's representing those people who traditionally look to the Conservatives to slow this process down?
That's a very, very good question. Talk about membership on my party, the grassroots and the activist base, and you're right, there are different views about all of this, and you know, closely engaged enough with my own base to know that there are different views and people hold some strong opinions, which they're not shy about telling me about. But what they are all passionate about is for Wales to do well and for the economy of Wales to succeed. And the challenge for people like myself who are taking this position now is to explain to not just the Conservative Party base but to the wider Welsh public why these powers are necessary in the 21st century. Actually, you've got to do this to get us into a position where we can make the most of the economic opportunities and overcome the economic challenges that the 21st century will bring. This isn't doing it because it's a nice thing to do. We're doing it because it actually puts our nation in a better place to compete internationally and compete economically in the 21st century. And I think, so this is why I use that phrase, powers with a purpose. I think people in Wales, particularly those who come from a more sceptical position about devolution, need to understand what this is all aiming to do. It's to strengthen our nation, to help provide a strong possible foundation for Wales to be a successful small nation in the 21st century.
Great, thank you very much. Please thank Stephen for his